Friday, August 23rd at Festival Hall, featuring from this year's Talent Search, soprano April Sorensen, cellist Ryan Anderson, dancers Leanne Elcano and Jacqueline Cole. For tickets, visit RacineSymphony.org. This is WGTD-FM. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW-Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jess Sheeler, an outreach and career transition specialist at Job Corps, Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW-Oshkosh, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Mangi. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. Today's program features author David Kerp. David Kerp is a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, a contributing writer at the New York Times, a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, as well as a member of the National Academy of Education. His most recent book, Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of the Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools, was awarded the 2014 Outstanding Book Award by the American Educational Research Association. Although that's not his most recent book, we are going to be talking today about his newest book called The College Dropout Scandal. So welcome, Dr. Kerp. Well, I'm just going to say, you tell us a little bit about the title. Why a scandal? What, there's a scandal? Do other people really recognize this as a scandal?
Well, it's funny that you should hone in on scandal. When the book went to the reviewers at Oxford Press, which is publishing it, one of the folks said, "Isn't that a bit of a strong word? How about problem?" And I said, "I sort of fall asleep by the time you get to the second syllable of the word problem in that context." But so here's what I think is the scandal. A huge number of students are dropping out without getting degrees. If you were to look at the students at your college, mm-hmm. I'd be really surprised if half of them made it through with a BA in 6 years. And if we look at the college where you're broadcasting from, I'm sure the numbers are lower than that. Mm-hmm. That's just a really sad situation, because what winds up happening is that millions of students wind up quitting college. They don't have a degree, and so they don't get the benefits that a degree offers. They've got all the liabilities. They've got the debt. They can't get the kind of jobs that they would need to pay off the debt. And many other ways their lives are changed. So that decision to leave school is huge. Now, that figures. 60% of the students graduate in 6 years. 40% don't in four-year schools. 38% of the students from community colleges graduate or transfer in 6 years. So that's a long chunk of time. Those numbers haven't changed much since the 1970s. In fact, they're a bit worse now than they were in the 1970s. We know what to do to move the needle. We have a bunch of strategies that we can talk about later in the show that will actually improve graduation rates. And the situation is particularly dire for minority students, for Pell Grant students, for students who are the first in their family to go to college. Those students I talk about as the new gen students in the book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, their graduation rate is 10 to 20% lower than the overall graduation rate. And we've got colleges that know how to, that have figured out ways not only of closing that gap, but in the case of Georgia State, which we may wind up talking about, those students graduated at a rate higher than the overall student body. So what you have is a tragedy in terms of wasted lives. You have no change in terms of what universities have been able to accomplish, despite the fact that they've got the tools to do something. That's the scandal.
Okay. Well, it is very provocative. And I did want to say to the listeners, full disclosure, some of you who are regular listeners know that I am a professor of education at Carthage College. So this obviously affects me and my institution. And I also prepare high school teachers whose students will be affected by whether or not colleges are effective in helping them grow and succeed. So anyway, I'm going to just bear out my self-interest in the topic. When this book came to us at the station, I sort of snapped it right up because this is something I'm interested in. In fact, a couple of months ago, and some listeners may have heard, I interviewed a recent graduate of Carthage and two of the people from the Advising Center about our first generation college student programs. And some of the things they were doing are related, but I think that your book goes into a huge amount of depth and really cites the research on what works. And so I thought it was very provocative. So anyway, what are the roots of this problem? I think you did a great job of describing it, but why are so many people dropping out of college?
Well, I think there are a bunch of reasons why this is true. Checked while I was talking to you. I just went online to check the graduation rate at Carthage. Do you happen to know what it is?
I think it's 68 or something like that.
58% in 6 years, which is pretty close to the average overall rate. Most of your students graduate in 4 years, far more than in other schools.
Yeah.
So what's the problem? Well, you know, if you're a traditionalist in this world, you blame the students, and you know, administrators of that stripe will say, "Give us better students, we'll get better graduation mm-hmm. rates." And indeed, the more, you know, the better prepared the students are, the more likely they are to graduate. But I think the real problem is students come to school and they need, this is the first time they're away from home in many cases. Many of them are, you know, it's a new life for them. They need lots of support. They need a sense that they belong to the institution, that somebody cares about them. They're not just sort of left to drift in their own devices. They're not just in the business of writing checks or having their parents write checks every semester or so. And if they don't get that feeling, if they feel that they don't belong, and right away in the first semester, if they wind up in trouble in their courses and there's nobody there to figure this out until the end of the semester, well, it's almost a sure thing that they're not going to stick around. Mm-hmm. So some students, you know, figure out when they're there, they don't really belong in college, really, really don't belong in college. Some have family obligations, some have money obligations. But we know from all the experience of successful schools that there's a huge difference in terms of the percentage of students who drop out among schools whose student profile is the same. And there's a huge difference in terms of the minority students and the new gen students who drop out among colleges whose overall graduation rate is the same. So it's not just on the students. Certainly not on the students. It's not just on the money. A lot of it has to do with what it is that the colleges are doing, or more importantly, not doing.
Okay. So you would not make the argument that I have heard some people make, that there are some students who just shouldn't really be in a college.
No, there are some students who shouldn't be in college. Uh-huh. But I don't think that's, you know, yes, there are some students who shouldn't be in college. And I don't think that lets college administrators or professors off the hook. If, for example, you know that the pass rate, the success rate of students who take non-lecture courses, who take what are called flipped classroom courses, where they're actually using class time to do something as opposed to sit there, like, you know, and listen to somebody pontificate on the stage or go to sleep or text their friends while this is going on, there's 50% more greater likelihood those students are going to pass in that kind of class rather than a flipped classroom class rather than a lecture class. You know, if there's no counseling available, or there's a counselor for every 1,000 students, which is not uncommon, well, you know, a lot of it is on the colleges. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the place to focus. Yes, one of the reasons I'm focusing on success rather than access is I frankly think that that's the biggest issue. What happens to students when they get into school? And somebody who doesn't think they belong can either be reassured in just that fact, you know, you really don't belong, or given a sense that they can do well. And I've seen some amazing programs that work, amazing turnarounds mm-hmm. in students who anybody would say, God, what is this person doing in a college classroom? You know, and they wind up very quickly catching on, doing well. I'm thinking now about a program at the City University of New York that takes students who, when I met them, you know, in August, those students, I don't know how they got their high school GEDs. They couldn't do negative numbers or decimal points in math, and they were writing 3-paragraph third grade level papers in the end of August. In November, they're simplifying square roots, and they're talking about ambiguity in the prose of V.S. Naipaul, which is pretty tough going. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Only if that's amazing, you know, but it says something about a combination of, you know, students who are willing to work and more, and as importantly, faculty members who are committed to teaching in an intelligent and effective way.
Right.
In short, you know, there's an issue, but it's not, you're a college professor or a college administrator. Your job isn't to wash your hands of students and say, well, you didn't belong here. Your job is to do everything you can to support the students that you've got.
Right. So the very first chapter of your book has a whole lot of strategies, and you tell about the research behind them that can help students succeed in their pivotal first year. So I made a list of them, but you can take your pick. What do you want to tell us about that really works?
Well, let's pick an easy one. So it turns out, to my great surprise, I learned a ton while writing this book. There's this phenomenon called summer melt, which right. doesn't have anything to do with the ice cream that you buy from the Good Humor Man that used to drive around, but has to do with students who have been accepted to college as seniors. They may very well have paid their first fees, and then they don't show up. They don't show up in the fall. And you think, what a weird thing that is. Well, at your typical big public university, that's 20-25% of the students mm-hmm. who are summer melt students. That's huge. What happened to those students? Well, in some cases they did decide, apropos our last question, conversation, that college wasn't for them. Or they decided that this wasn't the right time for them to be going to college. But in a lot of cases, what happens is they don't know. Students who are in this situation don't have, parents and family members who've been through this umpteen times. They don't have fancy, high-paid counselors who can help them sort their way through all the requirements they've got to meet between getting accepted and going to college. They've got to make sure that their high school transcripts are in. They've got to make sure that they've applied for all the financial aid. And let me tell you, those federal forms are a nightmare. They've got to sign up for orientation and what they're going to do in orientation. They have to figure out what their first semester schedule is going to look like. That is tough. And they've got other things to do. And teenagers procrastinate. So what to do about that question? Well, you go to teenagers where they live, which is in texts. And you text them little nudges, which say, you need to do X, Y, and Z. Let's just say it's filled out your financial aid form. It's due in a week. And if you're having problems with it, text us and we will help you work it through. So it's both a wake-up call and a we can help. Mm-hmm. So it works. It turns out, it works to the extent that the first school that tried this, which happens to be Georgia State, cut its rate of no-shows, its summer melt rate, from 19% to 12%. So that's huge. Wow. That's an almost 50% improvement, mm-hmm. If you figure that, in terms of the number of students who actually show up. And it costs, what does it cost? Nothing, really.
Right, because the technology
pennies
exists.
Per student. It's a nudge, and it's a, with backup if it's needed. So I think it's not just that it wakes up students. I think it's the first time of what hopes is going to be lots of other times that students get the idea that somebody cares about them, mm-hmm. that they're not just going to drift, that somebody is going to, in a friendly way, be on their case and be supportive of them.
Right.
So
well,
that's the easy one.
Yeah, one of the next things that I found really interesting was about the resilience and helping students find resilience. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, this is one of those too good to be true stories in some way, but then again, so is the nudge story. Again, as I said before, college students are an insecure breed at the beginning of college. They don't know. It's a whole new world for them. They don't know if they're going to fit. They don't know if they can do the work. It just, many of them are floundering. And even if they've come with, some of them have come with high school classmates, it's still going to be a concern for them. So social psychologists, many of them at Stanford, some of them elsewhere, have developed tools to boost two things. One of them, what's called growth mindset. What does that mean? Well, Carol Dweck, who wrote a very famous book called Growth, called Mindset, would argue that if a student is faced with a problem, somebody with a growth mindset is going to, if they failed to get it right the first time, they'll try again. And if they don't succeed, then they know enough to ask for help. And somebody, without a growth mindset is going to try the problem, fail, and say, I can't do it. I'm not smart enough to do it. And it is possible to show students how the brain actually works, that it, how the brain works in a way that it gets developed. It's a muscle. It works through exercise. It's not you can do it, you can't do it. So that's one kind of intervention or one kind of experience. And the other is one that says very directly, upperclassmen talking to a student, all of this done online, by the way, all this done at the beginning of the school year. You've got an older student saying, you know, when I came to college, I just thought I was the stupidest person around, you know, and I did really badly at my first test, and that made me just sure of that. But, you know, I got up my courage and I went to talk to the professor, and the professor, you know, said, you know, lots of folks have problems. Let's see what we can do to help. And then I started talking to my classmates who I thought would think I was a fool, and lo and behold, they didn't. And, you know, I made it, and here I am. And, you know, you can do the same. Mm-hmm. So that's a belonging exercise. Both of those online experiences take less than an hour.
Right.
And the impact on freshmen generally, and students generally, and particularly on new gen students, is extraordinary. I mean, it's the one big trial of this. This is now sort of being widely enough done so that people have stopped using trials. The one big trial was University of Texas. And the question was, how many of the students, you know, arrive at their second year fully prepared to be sophomores? And there was a huge gap between these new gen students and others in that context. And this experience that I've just described, this belonging experience around the issue of belonging, cut the rate of students who weren't prepared in half. Hmm. So instead of there being a 10% gap between these students, the overall student body and the new gen student body, that gap was cut to 5%. So how could that be? It's too good to be true. It's not about, the psychologists will say, it's not about the length of the experience that students have. It's all in the timing.
Right.
When students are primed to listen to somebody at a moment when they are insecure in their lives. And they listen to, particularly if it's the belonging experience, and they listen to somebody who's like them. Mm-hmm. That makes a huge difference. That makes a huge difference in their lives. And again, it plays out in terms of their persistence and their persistence to graduation.
Okay, so one of the areas where persistence is an issue is in mathematics. So I'm going to do a reintroduction break first, and then we'll talk about rewriting the math curriculum and how that has an effect. You are listening to WGTD HDFM, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of David Kerp's new book, The College Dropout Scandal, is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So one of the areas where new students, probably especially new gen students, have issues are with the required math courses. I know from having interviewed someone named Andrew Hacker about the math myth a few years ago that this is often a sticking point, even within community colleges, even in areas that are completely unrelated to math, such as maybe cosmetology or other fields, that people can't get past the math requirement and then they drop out. Is that something that you found in your research?
It is, and I'll tell you, it's near and dear to my heart because I'm absolutely math phobic, and I have no doubt that has to do with the fact that all my professors thought that I was an idiot in math. And you know, the fact that I had to take college calculus, and I remember that the grading curve was half, your grade was your raw score plus half the distance to 100. And there were take home exams in calculus. And my first exam, the raw score was 29, which translated into something like a 59 when it was shifted. And let's put it this way, I barely made it. And I barely made it because it was a horribly taught class. And I get math is often terribly taught. So I'm hugely sympathetic to students who are having problems in this area. I think there are two issues. One of them is the one that Andrew Hacker talks about. There is no earthly reason why somebody who isn't going to be going into a STEM field to have to be working and to learn calculus. The cosmopologist does not need calculus. Neither do people who are going to the liberal arts fields need calculus. What they do need is statistics, which is something that we use all the time. It's not just some arcane subject. It's going to have not just to do with work, but with a whole bunch of life activities. So one issue, and it's a huge issue, has to do with what the math is. And the second is, how is the math being taught? Is it a big lecture class, again, or is it being taught in a way that reaches students, acknowledges their insecurity, supports them along the way? There's a great program called StatWaves developed by the Carnegie Institute for the Advancement of Teaching. And Statways combines, you know, the mantra of Statways is make the course interesting, make the course relevant, and give students, you know, the psychological support that they need. And Statways, the students who take Statways and who come not having met the college math test requirement wind up in a year having taken a college credit level stats course, as well as having made up what it was that they needed, you know, to satisfy the basic math requirements. Again, the issue has to do with belonging in terms of the students and in terms of the university to recognize, as you were saying, this is the biggest, once students get to campus, this is the killer. Mm-hmm. Math is the killer. So you got to deal first with the calculus question and then with how the course is being taught. Now, some places use math labs. So you're working on a computer individually at your own speed. And you've got, if you run into problems, you raise your hand and there's somebody there in the math lab to come and help. That works. The other thing about these programs, the ones that are more individualized, the ones that are paying attention to what students need, is that the students who take those programs are much more likely to take advanced classes in math. Mm-hmm. It's not like a requirement that when they get through, they say, phew, I'm done with that. It's, I learned something interesting, and you know, maybe I want to know more stats than I thought I did. Mm-hmm. So this is really both on the faculty member and, you know, to change what she's doing, and it's really on the administration to say, okay, let's have a look at all the things that are standing in the way of students graduating, starting with they need to show up on campus, and ending with they've run out of $1,000 and they're dropping out in their last semester of their senior year. Why don't we give them that $1,000 so they can get across the finish line? And, you know, crucially in this is the changing of the math curriculum. And that's on any campus, that's a fight. And why is it that, you know, Andrew Hacker has got it exactly right. Why is it that the old rules still exist? Because, you know, faculty heads of departments that have been teaching and running sections that way, you know, they've got a great fiefdom. They also have this view about standards. You know, if you don't, calculus is the mother of all knowledge. Well, you know, everything, you pick the subject, history is the mother of all knowledge, science, right. You know, whatever you teach is the mother of all knowledge. Yep. And truth be told, there are skills that have to do with mathematics that are important, but they don't have to be taught the way that they are being taught in too many places now. Mm-hmm. That's so much for the sermon.
Right. No, I'm the one that brought it up, right? And I think it is a really, obviously, you know, lots of people are tackling that particular issue and sort of seeing it as a barrier for a lot of students. One of the sort of model institution that I see, I mean, there you do profile several places, but the one that you put front and center is Georgia State University in Atlanta. So just give us a bit of an overview. What kind of an institution is Georgia State, and how has it changed since 2003?
So Georgia State is your classic large 35,000-38,000 student regional public university. It's kind of, you know, the place that I compared it to when I was doing the research was Wayne State in terms of what the demographics are, mm-hmm. except there are many more minority students at Georgia State than there are at Wayne State. Mm-hmm. And it was just it was a run-of-the-mill, you know, university with a graduation rate of about 30-odd%, and with a big graduation gap between the new gen students and everybody else. What makes there are a number of schools that I profile, and they've done wonderful things and some quite different things. There's no cookbook answer to what you need to do, but Georgia State really took seriously, you know, the question that I posed before: what are the barriers that stand between, you know, students who show up and students who graduate? And they've tried to tackle all of them. So, for example, they collected data on student performance, student academic performance, going back 10 years for every subject, every student, every subject, 10 years worth of data. That's millions of data points. And then they crunch the numbers. And, you know, the thing about big data, as it's called, is data are stupid. People are smart. You got to ask the right questions to find out what to do. So, for example, by and large, when it's not until a student flunks a course – that somebody says, oh my gosh, there's really an issue here. It turns out that in an introductory course, a student that gets a C is a quarter as likely to graduate in the major that that course is in, a student who gets a B plus. So what does that mean? It doesn't mean you tell the student who gets a C, forget it, you're never going to make it. It means you want to focus attention on that student and not wait until the next course and that student gets another C and then eventually goes off elsewhere. You want to help them understand what the challenge is, what the alternatives look like, et cetera. And to do that, you need lots of smart counselors. And that's the second thing that's crucial that Georgia State did, which is at a time when it had no money and it started cutting administrators, it wasn't increasing faculty initially because it felt it needed to have smart counselors who are working with students. And it's a really good move. If you ask students, you know, what is it that helped you the most in college? They'll say over and over again, I heard so-and-so had my back. Had my back. And that so-and-so is more often than not a good counselor. And they're well-trained counselors. They need to understand something about, you know, a lot about academics and also a lot about the sort of personal lives of students, because those are not disconnected things. If you're a kid and you're working 80 hours or 60 hours a week, or you've got an hour commute, or, you know, those are the kinds of things that seriously get in the way. And if an advisor has got to help you figure out how to deal with the life problems, as well as getting you focused on the academic problem. So that for starters, just one last, you know, and the range of strategies includes the reworking of the math class. It includes creating clusters of courses that students take initially so they can figure out, do I really want to do a STEM major or would I rather do a humanities major? They take basic courses that will work for all of the subjects in those fields. Then they make a decision. That business of paying, you know, $500, $1,000 to kids who just have run out of money, and that's what's keeping them right from graduating, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, so the just-in-time grants program seemed really, really smart, because I can imagine, and, you know, sometimes we never hear about why our students sort of stop, but I think it can be just as simple as my transmission went out and now I can't get to school, or my ex is late with the child support, so I can't pay for daycare, or something like that, right? So tell us how they handle that at Georgia State.
No, those are exactly the issues. I mean, the first thing, again, you got data, lots of it. You got lots of numbers, but if somebody doesn't ask the right questions about the data, it just sits there. They're trying to figure out all these students are dropping out as seniors. That's weird, you know, because, you know, they're that close to getting a degree. What's going on? And what turned out to be the case is exact, you know, they're dropping out because they couldn't pay their bills. Why couldn't they pay their bills? Because they didn't get the child support from their ex. They didn't get their car transmission fixed. They're a month behind in their rent. They lost their job because the company closed, whatever. And for those students, you know, a small grant, not another loan, but a small, no-strings grant, here's $500, here's $1,000, has made all the difference. I mean, hundreds of students every year who would not otherwise have graduate because there's that kind of a contribution that's being made. And I think it works two ways. It's the money they need, and it's also a statement that says, the college cares about me. Somebody is noticing what's going on, and somebody is going to try to help me fix it, as opposed to, you know, I ran out of money, tough luck, goodbye.
So I'm going to say again, you are listening to WGTD HDFM. This is Education Matters. We are talking about David Kerp's new book, The College Dropout Scandal. This discussion will be archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You're invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So one common program, I think, you know, it's been decades now that colleges have tried to do sort of a summer bridge program for new students who they feel might be more challenged in college. Is that an effective strategy or not, or does it depend on how it's done?
Oh, I think you. It's always right. The answer to those questions is you're suggesting it's always and how well things are being implemented. So if you style that summer program as, you know, you're pretty dumb, but we think that if we give you a little bit of help, we can, you know, we can make you smart enough to make it. It's not going to work. If you provide the kind of basic courses that other students who are at the university might also take, in addition to which you're providing the how to succeed in college courses, and you tie what happens in the summer to what happens, you know, when classes begin, then indeed a summer bridge program can make a big difference.
Yeah, I can see this. So this isn't an exact parallel, but my son was a freshman in high school last year, and he was going from a fairly small middle school program to a giant high school with 1,000 freshmen. And they let them take a course in the summer. That's just a regular course. They offer it during the year. It's sort of like an introduction to computer applications or whatever. And so then he had 3.5 weeks where he was there every morning and learned his way around this giant building, met a few people. And I think that made a huge difference to him. And nobody ever said, oh, this is because you're dumb. So I think that probably helped too.
That signal mm-hmm. is really important. When I talk to students who have these programs, I mean, that's what they said. I get this letter initially and I thought, oh, they think I'm dumb. No matter how the letter was couched, they tried very hard to not communicate that. But, you know, the student said, once I got there and I realized what the program was about, and I was meeting students who are at the university who are taking a course during the summer that they hadn't taken during the year. I had some familiarity with the campus. I had some connection to other students. I was in much better shape when the academic year began than students who hadn't had that program. So they became converts. And, you know, I'm a skeptical academic. I want to make sure that I'm a journalist. I want to make sure that I'm not getting canned answers. But I talked to lots of students, and all of them said the same thing, that they started out dubious. They wound up thinking that this was a great thing for them to have been able to do.
Mm-hmm. So I don't think that you touched on this in your book, and I just thought of it, so I hope it's okay to ask it. How do online courses fare in this whole thing? You know, so some colleges offer a lot of online courses or allow students to take online courses elsewhere and transfer them. Are those helpful, or does the sort of lack of human connection mean that it's worse, or maybe you haven't looked into this? I don't know.
Oh, no, I did indeed. In discussing a university that I frankly had never heard of, but second biggest university in the country, University of Central Florida, they used online classes a lot because they couldn't afford to build. They didn't have the money. Florida is a pretty cheap state when it comes to higher education. They didn't have the money to build their way into the kind of expansion that was needed. And there, the students who took online courses, just online courses, did a bit worse than the students who took just courses in classrooms. And the students who did best took a mixture of the two. And that's because those online courses were not just canned lectures. Every one of them was a reinvented course. When you talk to the faculty about this, they said, the first thing you need to know if you're doing an online course is it's not at all like doing a course in class. And so the courses were lively. There was a chance for students to exchange, to have sort of offline conversations. And there were office hours on campus if you wanted them, or virtual office hours if that's what you wanted. And this generation of students liked that. What they liked about it was this sense, when it worked because they felt there was a professor who cared about them. And for the professor's point of view, it's clear this is no easy way out. You work harder if you're teaching an online course than otherwise. If what you're doing is just, you know, if what you're doing is giving students a sort of canned set of materials and say, go master this, well, we have some evidence that doesn't work. I mean, students really do badly in that context. It all depends on both the quality of the material and, most importantly, the availability of real human interaction.
Okay. So, when you were talking about rewriting the math curriculum, part of what you were describing is what we in higher ed call the flipped classroom. But I don't know if every listener has ever even heard of that term, so I'd like you to describe it rethinking the big lecture format. Describe how a big introductory course looks in before, when it's a lecture, and in the after format. Either, I think you talked about English as well as math courses.
Yeah, it works for a whole variety of courses. So in the classic course, the professor stands up, and she gives a lecture for whatever, 50 minutes. And maybe or maybe not, the lecture is also online. Students come or don't come, pay attention or don't pay attention. And they've got homework. They've got reading assignments for the week, which they do or don't do. And they have maybe a couple of exams and a final exam. And that's the class. In the flipped classroom, what the lecture covers is what the students are learning on their own time. So they're reading the material. They're getting the content. There is no less efficient way to transmit knowledge that I know than for somebody to lecture you about it. That isn't the way people learn. People learn. It's just too fast, goes by too fast, and you can't really have at it in your own time. If you have the same material available to you online, which you can work on at home, then you come to class. And often in flipped classrooms, the class begins with a quiz. Now, that sounds kind of high schoolish, but you know, there's a lot of data that says that students do better if there are weekly quizzes in the class. But more importantly, what's happening in the classroom is the kind of problem solving, you know, that in which real learning is taking place. It's a discussion opportunity. And it's a discussion opportunity, the structure which is going to vary with what the professor wants to do. But what's not happening is that everybody is sitting there and paying attention to one person in front of the classroom. But that you use the classroom time to create those group problem-solving opportunities, and you use the homework time to have students prepared with a background that allows them to do that in class.
Yeah, it seems like that lecture format is left over from a time when, I guess, information was harder to come by, and so you needed someone to deliver it in what I suppose was an efficient manner at one point. But now we can all get copies of all of these things that the lecturer has read and put together in a lecture. Or you can make a video of that lecture if you really still want to give it, I guess.
So I'm cynic enough to say you could always have turned the lecture into something that students could read, you know, in a thing called a book.
Mm-hmm.
And they've had those for a long time. I think the reason that lectures have hung out, there are two reasons. One, it's the way professors themselves learned. You know,
right.
We go back to how much training does a professor at a college have to teach? Well, if they're in a community college, they've got at least some training, usually, and they're totally dedicated to teaching. If you're teaching at a four-year university, it's likely that you have zero training. You go into the classroom and you start teaching, and you have to learn on the job. And where do you start? You start with what it was that your professor did when you were a student, and what did they do? They lectured. So I think that's the biggest explanation. It's also the case that lecturing is a really easy way to teach. You just stand up there, you take your notes out, you give a lecture, you go away. If the students get it, that's cool. If they don't get it, it's on them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, unfortunately, that's a diminishing norm, but that is still the norm in too many places. We're going to present this material to you in this antiquated form. Maybe we'll put it online, but we're going to put it online again in this sort of straight lecture format. And the rest of it is free. You know, if you make it, great. If you don't make it, you know, that's too bad. And, you know, among many things that's wrong with that is it doesn't provide any vehicle for supporting students who are having a hard time, which is something that in a classroom, when you've got students working on problems, it's much easier to catch those difficulties and work one-on-one or in small groups with students to overcome those hurdles.
Right. So as predicted, I have more questions than we have time, but I do want to ask a couple that I think are kind of important. So I have a friend who is an advisor at one of the UW system schools, and she works specifically with a group of kids who have aged out of foster care. So essentially they are independent adults, but they have no family. Like they have nowhere to go home to when college is out. So did you run across any programs for students like that?
So I went looking to find programs that might exist. It's not something that I had looked into, but I thought it's a really important question. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, you know, that's what I would recommend is going online and putting in that question. It took me about 5 minutes to come up with some interesting examples. But, you know, Western Michigan University turns out to have the best program in the country. And what do? They, you know, both pay the bills because these students aren't going to have any money, and not just tuition. They pay for their support, and they provide them a very heavy dose of advising and counseling because these are students who often have been bounced around from place to place. They've had nobody to help them along the way. They've got, you know, many of them have emotional support problems. Their graduation rates are horrific. Something fewer than 10% of those kids are going to graduate from college. And at Western Michigan, you know, where they started this program, the overall graduation rate there is 54%. The graduation rate for foster students is 44%. Not as good as it ought to be, but that's a whole lot better than 10%.
Right.
And there are other places. University of Pennsylvania is helping a bunch of colleges. City University of New York Community Colleges is partnering with a nonprofit, and they actually have a counselor living with foster care students while they're going to school. What's all of that about? It's about, and this is, I mean, the other huge theme of this, of the book, and, you know, huge part of the solution to the dropout scandal, is the importance of the personal connection, the importance of the human touch. Mm-hmm. The idea that somebody cares about me, and somebody is, or if I've got problems, there's somebody who has my back. That makes all the difference in the world. And if you think about what your life is like as a college student, I think about what my life was like and how much, you know, easier and saner it would have been if that was part of my experience. And this isn't just something that's true for, you know, regional college, the universities that 99% of American kids go to. It's true at even the most elite schools, which is why there's a chapter about Amherst College. Amherst doesn't have a dropout problem, but it had a huge belonging problem. And there was a campus-wide, what they call the Amherst Uprising, you know, which they had to, you know, which was the way of saying, dear administration, you got to pay attention to how it, you know, it's great that you've admitted all these new gen students. Now make us feel part of this community. So whatever the institution, you know, the administrators sitting out there, let's say University of Wisconsin, saying, not my problem. Well, it is, because mm-hmm. these same issues of belonging and feeling attached and changing the way in which courses are taught and other aspects of the institution are designed to make a student feel like they belong. That's everywhere. That's every institution's issue.
It is everywhere. So my final question to you is, your publicist sent me an extra copy of the book. Who on my campus needs to have this in their hands?
I love that question. And my answer is somebody who would take it seriously, who actually might do something, pick up on some of the ideas and make them happen on the campus. Whether it's in the classroom or the administration, and somebody who would buy a copy of the book or buy a bunch of copies of the book and give them to other like-minded people and say, hey, you ought to read this. It's an important book to have.
Okay. I think I know who that is, but I'm not going to put them on the spot by mentioning them on the air. Well, David Kerp, we've run out of time, but thank you very much. You are listening to WGTD HDFM on Education Matters. We were talking with Dr. David Kerp about his book, The College Dropout Scandal. You can listen again on our WGTD.org website. Thank you very much, Dr. Kerp.
Thanks so much. It's been great talking to you.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page. Support comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, featuring Roll With It, offering a variety of egg rolls. The current hot seller is the Bacon Breakfast Roll, stuffed full of eggs, green onion, cheddar, and bacon. The market is open Saturdays from 9 until 2 on 2nd Avenue and Plaza Duay.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Racine Theater Guild and the Racine Children's Theater will present their class-to-stage production of Schoolhouse Rock Live, Friday, August 16th at 6 and the 17th at 2. Tickets and more information are at racinetheater.org.
This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations.